Welcome to Local Talk Wednesday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. Thank you for listening in. I am your host for today, Susan Franson. Today's program is special and especially different. It is dedicated or inspired by Janet Kloss, who has been a sustaining member of KHOI since we went on the air 5 years ago. Thank you for all you have given to Ames, Janet, and we'll talk about some of that later. But for now, we hope to share some of your favorite things with our listeners, many of whom are your friends as well. Since I know that the one personal possession in your hospice room is a radio with both speakers tuned to KHOI, this program will feature some music from your albums. I'll start with The Northern Star by Elizabeth Zimmerman.
Just like the sea, ground.
That was a song by local singer-songwriter Elizabeth Zimmerman in a recording, Stuff of Dreams, which Janet Kloss donated this week, along with the rest of her extensive CD collection, to KHOI. And Elizabeth is also very special to KHOI. She was one of the early local musicians who played here. Janet values the work and talents of local musicians, but she had many other interests, and she worked behind the scenes in many places since she came to Ames in 1973. So some of you who don't know her may have been impacted one way or another if you ever went to the research desk in the Ames Public Library. He was even behind the scenes there, taking care of special collections, especially the Farwell T. Brown collection, which we'll hear more about later. And she was very instrumental in a lot of things at KHOI, although she was never on the air. And she was a co-host with Mary Richards of Community Bookshelf. But one of the most important things to her was the Ames Historical Society, or rather the work of Farwell Brown, the founder of the Ames Historical Association, which preceded the AHS, whose collection of photographs documenting the history of Ames was cataloged and conserved by Janet when she was at the Ames Public Library. Last night, I saw Dennis Wendell, collections curator of the Ames Historical Society, who told me about how Janet carried forward the legacy of Farwell by editing and publishing three volumes based on his family papers. With Cindy Pease and others, she also collected and transcribed interviews with local historical figures. But Local Talk Wednesday is a program dealing with our surrounding area. And this is where Janet's husband, Irv Kloss, comes in. She came with him in 1973, I believe, to Ames when he became the director of fisheries and wildlife at Iowa State. So her literary interests and his concern with the environment were complementary in their lives in Ames. And so we'll return to some of your interests later, Janet. But now I want to balance it out with something important to all of us, water. If I were sitting by your bedside, I might tell you about this without the recorded voices. On Monday evening of this week, I attended the first of several listening sessions sponsored by Prairie Rivers of Iowa. It was at the Gilbert City Hall, and about half of the 30 participants were high school students. The discussion was lively and varied, and a summary of some of the suggestions that came out of it was emailed a couple of days later to all of those attending. So it was a real working session with the idea that it was going to continue. The general meeting was capped by a detailed slide presentation done by the high school students comparing the water quality studies of Kegley Branch and College Creek. These are creeks and watersheds, parts of watersheds, and we'll hear more about that. After it was finished, I had a chance to talk with three of the students and their teachers, their teacher, Cara Reinhardt.
I taught 8th grade science for 10 years, and we've been testing College Creek for 10 years. And then someone from the DNR gave Dan Haug my name because they just started the Kegley Branch research. And so these fabulous students had already been to the creek once. And so they came with us this year. We decided to go to Kegley Branch with Dan and then just do some research on the Kegley Branch. So, and they'd already had some previous experience, so it was a great opportunity.
So all of the students at Gilbert know what a watershed is?
I think many of them do, or they should.
Has this always been something of concern in this area?
I think it's always been a concern in this area. We just, for instance, in our own class, like I've been teaching this for about 10 years because I had been made aware of the issues in Iowa. I'm originally from Texas, so I didn't even know, but I just had recently become aware of all the nitrates and issues and...
This sounded impressive, but I wondered how the students felt about what they had done. I spoke with Jacob Teresi, Eleanor Lopez, and Brett Porter. Was this your first venture into water testing?
Well, we did another set of testing at College Creek 2 years ago in eighth grade because she was also our teacher then. And then we were pretty excited that we were doing it again at a different creek.
Why was it exciting?
Well, because it's pretty fun to find those benthic macroinvertebrates, the little critters. So, yeah.
Do the rest of you think that's a fun thing to do?
Yeah, except for the fact that you get kind of dirty. And it's really cold.
I noticed that College Creek was quite a bit warmer than Kegley Creek.
I think I remember it being warmer. I mean, we went in the spring the last time we did it, and now going in October, it was colder. I don't know if, like, the temperature probably varies based on when you tested the creek anyways.
And so is this your first try at water testing?
No, similar to them, I also went in eighth grade with Mrs. Reinhardt because she was our teacher then as well. But that was at College Creek, so this is our first time at Kegley Branch.
Do you feel that you understand more what you're doing now that this is your second time around?
Yeah, I do feel like since it's our second time going and after learning all of our mistakes we made the first time, I feel like the second time we did a lot better and we focused more on the data because when we were in eighth grade, we probably messed around a bit more than we should have.
You look dubious about that. Since you don't like to get dirty, but did that hamper you in doing the testing?
No, because my group was actually habitat testing, so we didn't really have to get into the creek. And same for chemical testing. The physical and biological are the ones that you actually need to get in there and dig for the stuff.
Habitat testing.
Where you look around, like, the outside of the creek and in it, just at the general surroundings and what's around the creek, not necessarily, like, the actual water.
Well, now you have a lot of data. What do you see the use of this?
I see the use of all this data as, well, it's going to be useful for the Prairie Rivers Association that we helped out with finding the data for, but it's also going to help the students who found it just learn more about the environment they're around and even what they can do in their backyards, like Mrs. Reinhardt is teaching us about every day at school.
Can you literally go to your backyard?
In my backyard, I live in Cameron Estates, and I actually can go to my backyard, and there's a river back there.
What's the use you see of this data you gathered?
We just got to learn a lot, and I think it's kind of cool how these are, like, real-life issues, not just stuff we're, like, reading out of a textbook. We're actually helping the environment, and, you know, hopefully we can get some better drinking water because that's good for everyone, and we just got to learn about the environment.
Well, when you're not in the river testing it, do you go ever over there and fish or wade or canoe or anything?
Not in the Kegley Branch or College Creek, but I do like to fish and swim like a lot of people do.
I actually have a story that me and Brett went swimming in, I believe it's the river by Brookside Park, and then I stepped on a submerged log. And my foot ended up getting really infected, and I ended up in the ER because that water was full of bacteria.
So that would have been nice to know beforehand. Nice to know that the water you're swimming in was safe if you're going to do recreational activities. So that's another good use for this data is just having the comfort to know that you can go out into your creeks by your house and be safe.
So anybody want to add anything to that?
Like I said before, it's just cool to me that we're actually drinking this water, swimming in this water, or, like, fishing in the water that we're testing. So it's nice to see that it's actually impacting our lives.
Here's Cara's summary of the class project.
The students are just fabulous. They work really hard and do a great job collecting data and putting the data together. And so it's been really a fun adventure, and they're just a joy to teach.
Well, I noticed you had a pretty impressive slideshow.
And that was all student put together. So the students worked on that. They had a couple of days after we went to the creek, and then they knew that they were going to present tonight. So that was all student work.
And what about the adult audience members? Were there many parents there, or were they just mostly people who were really concerned with the issue?
It looked to me like there were probably one-third parents and two-thirds farmers and people in the area that were concerned about the issue.
In case you're just tuning in, this is KHOI Community Radio, and I'm your host for today, Susan Franzen, taking you to a listening session put on by Prairie Rivers of Iowa in Gilbert City Hall last week about how we can make the creeks and rivers in our watershed safe for people to bring and bring it to a healthier water life. Incidentally, the reason this, well, you'll hear why the reason this particular branch was chosen. The purpose of these sessions was to enable people living and farming near these waterways to decide how to make the water better and life-sustaining. This program has been dedicated to Janet Kloss, whose commitment to music, literature, and history has been life-sustaining in other ways. Now, back to Gilbert. While I was talking to the students and their teacher, the other adults were in small groups talking about the information that came from the formal part of the program at the beginning. At the end of the night, I caught Rick Lopez and Cheryl Moss for their recap of the evening and how it related to their concerns.
I think agriculture is important in the state, and doing it responsibly is important to this state and to the future generations. So we as landowners, whether residential or agricultural, have a responsibility to the future generations.
And I live right on a Kegley Creek, and I'm a cancer survivor, and I was young when I had cancer, and I'm concerned about all we get from the water that we drink, the well water, and I want to know if it's safe or if it's not safe. And I know that what we do to the land and the watersheds makes a difference.
So that's why you're here. And were you impressed with the approach of the people who pulled this together, the listening session?
Yeah, you bet. It was impressive. I thought the students did a nice job. They were obviously directed by some people who have some experience, which was nice to see.
I enjoyed seeing the kids up there giving what they'd learned, and I appreciate the work of their teacher, Mrs. Reinhardt, with that.
You have been to one of the breakout sessions. Did you feel that there were any beginnings of good ideas or cooperation?
Maybe our group was a little light on the good ideas, but I think starting the conversation was a good thing.
I think we had a list of problems and concerns, and I think we started to come up with some possible pursuits of trying to find out solutions.
What is the biggest problem that you see?
I guess I don't see the problems in our immediate area because our neighborhood is such that the runoff goes through grass and goes through woods, which I think is probably an optimal setup before it drops into the creek. So, but it's a well-established neighborhood, and that's something that took decades to establish. So as new neighborhoods pop up, those are things that need to be thought about for the new areas.
You actually live in the country, isn't that right, Cheryl?
That's right, and I see my land dropping into Kegley Creek often. We don't own a lot of land. We own an acreage, but it's right in the rural part of the county. And I'm concerned about the quality of life with these issues. We talked in my group quite a bit about manure and having witnessed big patches of manure over time and just becoming more informed about what's happening and if those are being dealt with in an appropriate way.
Have you had any flooding issues?
No, I'm fortunate to live in an area that we're pretty immune. We're at a high level.
We've had all of the flooding, and I just accept that part of our land is part of the floodplain, and it's kind of surrounded by Skunk River and Kegley Creek. And it's okay, except when we get those floods. I remember I think it was the 97 flood that took out the old Soper's Mill Bridge that was a carriage bridge, so it had been there a very long time. And when I lived there, that it was wiped out by a flood. And we've had water where my kids could put in at our house and go all the way to the river across a couple of farms. And so we've had quite a bit of flooding problems in that area.
Do you see that there is likely to be a positive outcome from these kinds of meetings? I guess there are going to be several more.
I think so. I think apathy and lack of knowledge are probably the two dominant problems at this stage, and the more people learn about it, the better it'll get.
Yeah, I think this is a great, and it's great to see the kids involved with the studies, because the more information they get now, and they're the kids that get out there and will be doing recreational things on the rivers, and so now they'll know what they're seeing as they paddle by or ride their tubes down the river or the creek. So I think these are a great opportunity for everybody to get to know more information.
Now that we've heard from the participants, I wanted to get a little background about the goals of the listening sessions. So I talked to Irv Kloss.
And when this was formed, a lot of the rural landowners thought that this group from Ames is just going to come up here and tell us how to farm. And it wasn't that at all. What we wanted to do was to hear each other's problems and see if we could solve these things cooperatively. And so it was very interesting to me that at one of the first meetings of that watershed authority, for the first time, officials from the city of Ames heard what was going on in the watershed concerning drainage and the replacement of large tile lines that affect the flooding problem in Ames. And so they had to come to, they learned of this in that discussion, that how this was done and how this flooding was caused by this drainage, and they didn't understand it fully before. So now I think we're talking to each other, and that's what's important. And so we want to continue that model of watershed management authorities in all the small watersheds. So this new Keighley branch has some of the same people that are involved with the Quail Creek. Ames is still part of that. Story County is still part of it, but we've added, and Hamilton County is still part of the same group, but we've added a little bit of Hardin County, and we've got the towns of Roland and Story City and Randall in that watershed that are not in Squaw Creek. So now we've got to have a new group to talk about the problems in Keighley Branch. So the purpose of these listening sessions that we're doing is to learn what people are doing and what they think needs to be done in order to solve this nutrient reduction problem and clean up our rivers. What we've been providing is cost share funding to landowners to provide them with money to help or help them put in practices that we think will benefit the water quality, that is, reducing nitrates and phosphates and all that. So we've got a system set up that the landowners can actually pick what they want to put on. And we've targeted some of these things. The things that we're cost-sharing on are primarily no-till, which means they use no-till practices, and also cover crops. Those are the two things that the nutrient reduction strategy has identified will do the most efficient job of removing these pollutants, nitrates and phosphates. Wetlands are also on our list, and that's a really efficient way of doing it. And then what we call edge of field practices, things like bioreactors, which are large pits that are dug next to a stream in which tile lines are flowing, and we fill that pit with wood chips. And the wood chips provide a substrate for bacteria to grow on that will actually use up nitrates and convert them to nitrogen gas and give off to the atmosphere. And then over time, that reduces the amount of nitrates because those tile lines now flow through that wood chip bed before it reaches a stream. And we found that that's a very effective way to remove nitrates. Another practice is what we call saturated buffers. Where there's a buffer strip, that is a strip of vegetation along a stream, that will help to reduce the amount of sediment and nutrients flowing into the stream from the side. There's tile lines in that buffer strip which go under the buffer strip, and if so, they're not the strip itself doesn't have any effect on the water from the tile line. So what a saturated buffer does is to take that tile line and put a T in it and divert the water laterally, parallel with the stream, into the buffer strip itself. And then the vegetation itself takes up the nutrients from that tile line. And then eventually, of course, it runs into the stream and with much less nitrate. So those are some of the practices that we've been working on, but including grass waterways, all the smorgasbord, I guess you'd say, or the toolbox we sometimes call it, of practices that landowners can use on their farms, depending on what they want to do on a voluntary basis to reduce the nutrients that are going into streams.
This is KHOI Community Radio, Story City, Ames, and the surrounding area. This program is dedicated to Janet Kloss, so far focusing on her work at the Ames Historical Society and her music collection. I'd like to turn to her appreciation of literature and fostering that appreciation in others. With Mary Richards, she's been co-producer of Community Bookshelf since KHOI went on the air 5 years ago. And for those of you who don't know it, it is at 1 o'clock Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for half an hour. And it features local authors whose books are read aloud a half hour at a time, three times a week. I don't believe I've ever heard Janet read on the air, so I can't play anything from the archives. However, from my own personal archives, I found a reading from a Sand County Almanac by native Iowan Aldo Leopold that we read together for the first Ames Reads Leopold. I still have our parts that we read together, and they're still written in pencil in the margins, Susan and Janet. I think it's a suitable reading for today, however, so I'll read both parts. Janet, if you're listening, can you hear your part? I wish we could read it together. It's titled The Good Oak. It's February. There are two spiritual dangers in not owning a farm. One is the danger of supposing that breakfast comes from the grocery, and the other that heat comes from the furnace. To avoid the first danger, one should plant a garden, preferably where there is no grocer to confuse the issue. To avoid the second, he should lay a split of good oak on the andirons, preferably where there is no furnace, and let it warm his shins while a February blizzard tosses the trees outside. If one can cut, split, haul, and pile his own good oak and let his mind work for a while, he will remember much about where the heat comes from, and with a wealth of detail denied to those who spend the weekend in town astride a radiator. And this is Janet's. The particular oak now aglow on my andirons grew on the back of the old emigrant road where it climbs the sandhill. The stump, which I measured upon felling the tree, has a diameter of 30 inches. It shows 80 growth rings, hence the seedling from which it originated must have laid in its ring of wood in 1865 at the end of the Civil War. But I know from the history of present seedlings that no oak grows above the reach of rabbits without a decade or more of getting girdled each winter and resprouting during the following summer. Indeed, it is all too clear that every surviving oak is the product either of rabbit negligence or of rabbit scarcity. Someday some patient botanist will draw a frequency curve of oak birth years and show that the curve humps every 10 years, each hump originating from a low in the 10-year rabbit cycle. A fauna and flora, by its very process of perpetual battle within and among species, achieve collective immortality. It is likely, then, that a low in rabbits occurred in the middle 60s, when my oak began to lay on annual rings, but that the acorn that produced it fell during the preceding decade, when the covered wagons were still passing over my road into the Great Northwest. It may have been the wash and wear of the emigrant traffic that bared the road bank and thus enabled this particular acorn to spread its first leaves in the sun. Only one acorn in 1,000 ever grew large enough to fight rabbits. The rest were drowned at birth in the prairie sea. It is a warming thought that this one wasn't, and thus lived to garner 80 years in June sun. It is the sunlight that is now being released through the intervention of my axe and saw to warm my shack and my spirit through 80 gusts of blizzard. And with each gust, a wisp of smoke from my chimney bears witness to whomsoever it may concern that the sun did not shine in vain. My dog does not care where the heat comes from, but he cares ardently that it come, and soon. Indeed, he considers my ability to make it come as something magical, for when I rise in the cold black pre-dawn and kneel shivering by the hearth making a fire, he pushes himself blandly between me and the kindling splits I have laid on the ashes, and I must touch a match to them by poking it between his legs. Such faith, I suppose, is the kind that moves mountains. It was a bolt of lightning that put an end to wood-making by this particular oak. We were all awakened one night in July by the thunderous crash. We realized that the boat must have hit nearby, but since it had not hit us, we all went back to sleep. Man brings all things to the test of himself, and this is notably true of lightning. Next morning, as we strolled over the sandhill, rejoicing with the coneflowers and the prairie clovers over their fresh accession of rain, we came upon a great slab of bark freshly torn from the trunk of the roadside oak. The trunk showed a long spiral scar of barkless sapwood, a foot wide and not yet yellowed by the sun. By the next day, the leaves had wilted, and we knew that the lightning had bequeathed to us 3 cords of prospective firewood. We mourned the loss of the old tree, but knew that a dozen of its progeny, standing straight and stalwart on the sands, had already taken over its job of wood-making. We let the dead veteran season for a year in the sun it could no longer use, and then, on a crisp winter's day, we laid a newly filed saw to its bastioned base. Fragrant little chips of history spewed from the saw cut and accumulated on the snow before each kneeling sawyer. We sensed that these 2 piles of sawdust were something more than wood, that they were the integrated transect of a century, that our saw was biting its way stroke by stroke, decade by decade, into the chronology of a lifetime, written in concentric annual rings of good oak. It took only a dozen pulls of the saw to transect the few years of our ownership during which we had learned to love and cherish this farm. Abruptly, we began to cut the years of our predecessor, the bootlegger, who hated this farm, skinned it of its residual fertility, burned its farmhouse, threw it back into the lap of our county with delinquent taxes to boot, and then disappeared among the landless anonymities of the Great Depression. Yet the oak had lain down good wood for him. Its sawdust was as fragrant, as sound, and as pink as our own. An oak is no respecter of persons. The reign of the bootlegger ended sometime during the Dust Bowl droughts of 1936, 1934, 1933, and 1930, oak smoke from his still, and peat from burning marshlands must have clouded the sun in those years, and alphabetical conservation was abroad in the land. But the sawdust shows no changes. Rest, cries the chief sawyer, and we pause for breath. Now, this is quite a long reading, and I think I will skip to the end, past these pages with Janet and Susan written on them. This was my reading. Now comes the job of making wood. The maul rings on steel wedges as the sections of the trunk are upended one by one, only to fall apart in fragrant slabs to be corded by the roadside. There is an allegory for historians in the diverse functions of saw, wedge, and axe. The saw works only across the years, which it must deal with one by one in sequence. From each year, the raker teeth pulls little chips of fact, which accumulate in little piles called sawdust by woodsmen and archives by historians. Both judge the character of what lies within by the character of the samples thus made visible without. It is not until the transect is completed that the tree falls and the stump yields a collective view of a century. By its fall, the tree attests the unity of the hodgepodge called history. The wedge, on the other hand, works only in radial splits. Such split yields a collective view of all the years at once, or no view at all, depending on the skill with which the plane of the split is chosen. If in doubt, let the section season for a year until a crack develops. Many a hastily driven wedge lies rusting in the woods, embedded in unsplittable cross-grain. The axe functions only at an angle diagonal to the years, and this only for the peripheral rings of the recent past. Its special function is to lop limbs, for which both saw and wedge are useless. The three tools are requisite to good oak and to good history. This is Janet's section. These things I ponder as the kettle sings and the good oak burns to red coals on white ashes. Those ashes come spring. I will return to the orchard at the foot of the sandhill. They will come back to me again, perhaps as red apples, or perhaps as a spirit of enterprise in some fat October squirrel, who, for reasons unknown to himself, is bent on planting acorns. And that's the end of this month in the Sand County Almanac. We have time to close the program with a very different piece of music from local musicians Jonathan Sturm and Meishan Huang playing the first movement of the Sonata in E-flat Major for Viola and Piano by Johannes Brahms. Thank you. That was the first movement of the Brahms Piano Concerto, played by Jonathan Sturm and Meishan Huang. We'll close the program with another piece from their album, Jonathan Sturm, Violin and Viola, Meishan Huang, Piano, performing Brahms, Bieber, and Franck. We also have time for the encore piece, Dancing Doll, by Edie Poldini. You have been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I have been your host, Susan Franzen. Today, thank you for listening. Earlier in the show, we heard from Cara Reinhardt, Jacob Torresi, Eleanor Lopez, Brett Porter, Rick Lopez, Cheryl Moss, and Irv Kloss. Local Talk airs at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. here on KHOI at 89.1 FM. Also, remember that you can also hear it online at khoifm.org and find links to guests and information you heard during the program. KHOI is streaming live online and at khoifm.org. Today's show was engineered by Rebecca Reuter. Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was Northern Star and Under the Moon by Elizabeth Zimmerman of Brahms Piano Concerto, played by Jonathan Sturm and Meishan Huang from their album Jonathan Sturm, Violin and Viola, Meishan Huang, Piano, performing Brahms, Bieber, and Franck. Dancing Doll by Edie Poldini. Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show. So if you would like to try your hand at reporting, we'll train you. And come and join our Local Talk team. Let us know what you think. You can call us at 515-292-2878, email us at khoiradio@gmail.com, or go to the contact page of our website, khoifm.org. Remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.
Support for KHOI comes from Stevens Auditorium, presenting One Night in Memphis, a night of rockabilly, country, gospel, and 1950s rock and roll, on Thursday, October 26th at 7:30 p.m. More information can be found at center.iastate.edu.
Support for KHOI comes from Mary Greeley Medical Center, providing inpatient and outpatient services on a continuum of care. Located at 1111 Duff Avenue in Ames. Find out more information at www.mgmc.org. That's mgmc.org.
Just like the sea, grounded and side. I'll never lose my way again. No matter the weather, because we are together and we Mm-hmm.